Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Good afternoon from the Florida Space Coast, everyone. This is your host, Daria Ann. Welcome to another RightStream Tuesday. I'm so glad you're joining me here today. I'm thrilled to be here. I have another excellent guest lined up. We're going to talk today about a new dystopia called Tears of Paradox, which is the first in a series entitled Storms of Transformation by author Daniela Bova. And so we're going to get that interview started here in just a couple of minutes. And I know you're going to enjoy it. But first, before we get to that, I just want to remind everyone to check out all of the great shows on the RightStream Radio Network. You can find out more about us at rightstreamradio.com. That's W-R-I-T-E, stream.com. Right now, we are broadcasting five shows on the network. Two right now are kind of on hiatus, but we have Just Believe with Lisa Tarvez every Sunday night, where Lisa delves into the metaphysical and holistic health and the paranormal. So it's a very, very interesting show. Lisa herself is an author of a book called Just Believe, which is about her experience with angels. Very excellent book, by the way, for anyone who is interested in angels and spirituality. Highly recommend her book and listening to Lisa's show every Sunday. And then on Mondays, I'm so pleased to have military historian, journalist, and documentarian, I'll call him, John D. Gresham, hosting Military Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern every week. John's name may be very familiar to you, and not because it sounds like another famous author, but also because he's appeared many times on various documentaries that you might have seen on the Military Channel or History Channel. John is just an expert in his field, and he brings on some very interesting guests, and they delve into various events that have taken place in military history, and also John also deals with current events, and unfortunately there's a lot to cover in terms of current events in the military these days, but that's Military Monday on the RightStream Network with John D. Gresham. And of course I host RightStream Tuesday every week at 1 p.m. where I bring on a variety of authors in different genres, mostly in the realm of fiction, although occasionally I do bring on nonfiction authors. But I do like to focus on independently published authors because I am one of them, but not just for that reason. I just have a lot of respect for authors who take a leap of faith and go the independent route and take advantage of all of the great new technology we have at our disposal now, and also take the time to write a good story, you know, seek out professional editing, crowdsourcing, and really just, like I said, take that leap of faith and put their work out there and connect with their audience, whether online and in person. I just really love that spirit of independence, and so that's why I tend to focus mainly on independently published authors on RightStream Tuesday. On Wednesday evenings, we have a great show called Family Power Hour with Dr. Billy Eisenberg and Sheena Benjamin Wise, which is on hiatus right now. The ladies have taken a little bit of a break for the summer, but they will be back with live shows and wonderful guests, I believe, starting in September, which is also when Lisa and I will begin broadcasting live shows of Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss, which is our fun women's lifestyle show. So you can check this all out at rightstreamradio.com. Just briefly about me, I am an independent author, blogger, ghostwriter, social media marketer, and founder of the RightStream Radio Network. I am available to provide content, ghostwriting and editorial services, social media services, helping authors navigate through the whole independent publishing process. I also work with small businesses, and you can find out more about me at DariaDiGiovanni.com. That's DariaDiGiovanni.com. And I have to say I'm really grateful to God because it seems like lately just the inquiries have increased dramatically. It seems like every day I'm getting an email from somebody asking me about the different services that I offer. So I'm really feeling very blessed and very thankful for one of the contracts I have that's really enabling me to have a foundation while I, you know, pursue other projects and take on new projects, which I do have one in the works right now. Don't have the author's permission to promote it just yet, but I'm very, very excited about it. Well, anyway, that's a little bit about me and the RightStream Radio Network. Let me get to my guest for this afternoon because I'm just thrilled to have her on board. She is an author that I met in the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance on Facebook, and my goodness, she feels like an old friend. And maybe because we have similar backgrounds. We are both from Pennsylvania. I believe Daniela still lives there, not too far from where I grew up. So we have that in common. We also have an Italian background in common. And I don't just appreciate her because she really loved my book and gave me a 5-star rating. I've just really enjoyed getting to know her, of course, in the online world. And it's just amazing how quickly people can become real friends, even though you've never met them in person. And so that's certainly the case with my guest today. But Daniela has written a great novel called Tears of Paradox. It's the first book in a series entitled Storms of Transformation. And before I bring her on the air, I just want to go ahead and read the synopsis of Tears of Paradox, which I've started to read, and I'm a paperback person. I know this is going to sound really crazy to people who know me and know I spend my whole life online, and my business obviously takes place online. But, you know, when it's time for me to relax and read a book, I just really love a paperback. So I've ordered Tears of Paradox. Amazon has assured me it is on its way. But after I placed the order, they allowed me to read, I believe it was about the first 50 or so pages. And I have to tell you, I was so disappointed when I got to the end of that and they said, oh, sorry, can't read anymore, because it's excellent. She's this is her first book, and I'm just very impressed with what she's done. But let me go ahead and read the synopsis, and then I'm going to bring Daniela on the air so she can tell us a little bit about herself and a little bit more about her book and this new series. Okay, so synopsis for Tears of Paradox by Daniela Bova. In the not-so-distant future, Michelle hides in the shadowy cornfields of rural Pennsylvania, waiting for her unborn child, targeted by the Untouchables who have assumed power. Michelle's husband, Jason, remains in their hometown, struggling against overwhelming odds to keep his wife and child from being found. The blue-collar Catholic couple have already endured numerous losses, including that of a baby son born under mysterious circumstances. This pair of childhood sweethearts and their family and friends have always stuck together, but the storms of transformation turn everything upside down. Friendships disintegrate, fathers and sons become enemies, and trust is a thing of the past. The ways of traditional America have gradually become what those in power term evil. What used to be evil is now the law, strictly enforced by the bureaucracy, and for ordinary people, there is no middle ground. You either play or pay. Deviation from government policy will land you in jail, or worse. Media figures who aren't part of the power structure begin slowly disappearing, and Jason must depend solely on God to help him save his wife and baby. Tears of Paradox is a story full of suspense, romance, sadness, humor, and nostalgia. A must-read for Americans in these rapidly changing times. And I have to tell you, I was getting chills just reading that synopsis, given what is currently going on. But let me welcome, without further ado, author Daniela Bova to RightStream Tuesday.
Hi, Daria.
Hey, Daniela, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You're welcome. And, you know, before we get started, I have to tell you I absolutely love your name, which I'm assuming is the Italian version of Danielle, which is a name I've always loved. But I just love saying your name. I love hearing it.
Thank you. Actually, it is a pen name, and it is a contraction of my father's name, Dante, and my name, which is Ellen. But I wanted to remember my father, who was a very creative man and gave me a really great upbringing, and really, like, shaped my life. And even though he's gone now, that was my way of bringing him into what I'm doing with my book.
Wow, that is such a wonderful tribute, Daniela. You're making me tear up here. That's really sweet.
Oh, and, thanks.
So, you know what, tell us, let's start, you know, I know I read the book synopsis, but tell us a little bit about you and your background first, and then we'll certainly get into talking about your book.
Okay. Would it be all right if I just read my from my website, my about section?
Absolutely, whatever makes you feel comfortable.
Okay. It probably might sound a little better than me trying to explain things. So it goes, I never believed I would write a book. Although I loved to read and dreamed of writing fiction, my life took a different path when I married at age 17, right out of high school. College was impossible for me. I was the mommy. I love my job as a mom, and I'm happy to say that my children have grown up to be wonderful people who do make a difference. As our family grew, my husband struggled through many menial jobs, including a stint in a fiberglass factory, while he put himself through school in order to make a better life for us. He worked multiple jobs, and I took care of the home, along with perfecting my passionate love of different forms of fiber artistry. We were happy always in our bubble of belief in a safe and peaceful world. That bubble burst for everyone on September 11, 2001, and my eyes pried open when the smoke filled the sky. No matter how much I wanted to close my eyes again, I was simply unable to go back to sleep, and I began paying attention to current events on September 12th. I'm still awake along with many other Americans, but even so, the idea of writing a novel never entered my mind. I didn't write anything except comments on other people's blogs. That changed, however, in the summer of 2009. The idea for this story came to me suddenly and without warning on a hot July day as I contemplated the situation America was and unfortunately still is facing with regard to waning respect for human life, health care, religious freedom, Second Amendment rights, and many other important issues. I was praying the rosary as I ran on a country road, staring at the tall corn in the woods on either side. I remember the exact stretch of road. It's isolated and wild with very little traffic. I was meditating on the past and the future when suddenly the idea came to me. What if everything turned upside down? As I ran up the hill, I pictured a young pregnant woman hiding in the corn, and that was the idea when the idea exploded brightly in my mind. The Storms of Transformation series was originally written as a single volume. However, the book was too long for a debut novel, and I came to realize it would be better to divide it into a series. Jason and Michelle's story continues in Volume 2 of the Storms of Transformation series. The book is entitled The Notice, and it will be published in December of 2014.
Oh, excellent. Oh, my gosh. Danielle, there's so much there. But, you know, I want to go back to something you said in your bio, and I think this is true for a lot of people. A lot of people were, and they use this expression, I know Michelle Malkin has used this a lot in describing, you know, the feedback she's received from famous actors, for example. But, you know, mugged by reality, I guess, on September 11th, 2001.
Right.
Many Americans... You know, and even, you know, some celebrities and famous Americans were, you know, that event kind of shook them out of their comfort zone as well. Myself, having grown up with an activist mom and dad, but, you know, my mom was the one that had more time to do those things. I kind of was always brought up with constitutional principles, but, it's amazing to me how many people I meet, took that experience to sort of, you know, change their perspective. So very interesting that you brought that up. So how was your, you know, for you personally, what was it like? Had you paid attention to politics at all before, or, you know, how did September 11th change your outlook?
I honestly did not pay attention at all. I was just living my life. My daughter had graduated high school and was in college, and my son was still in high school at the time, and I was just living my life. What I did back then, like, I've done a lot of different jobs in my life, since I did marry young and, like, basically was a mom, which I loved. I never really had the desire to have a career or work outside. I liked my house. I liked working at home. And I still like working on my own schedule. I've done a lot of... Pardon?
No, I was going to say, me too. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. My sister, on the other hand, loves work. She loves working outside the home. And she had her children, and I took care of her children for her. And, like, we're just one big happy family living here. My mother lives next door, and my sister lives next door on the other side. And it's just that was our life. My husband worked, and, like, we just didn't do what we should. Our daughter was in school. Son was in high school. I was watching my nieces, and I didn't know anything about Osama bin Laden. I might watch Peter Jennings on the news or, like, world news, you know, sometimes, and I would watch the local news at noon every day. I thought, oh, I'm informed. That's what, the day that it happened, I'll never forget. I was babysitting my niece because she was sick. She was in kindergarten. Her little niece was younger. And I saw what...
Danielle, you're cutting out a little bit. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's probably my phone because it's pouring rain here, and I'm afraid of the service. Anyway, it just, like, ripped the veil off of my head. I that's the only way I can explain it. I just thought America, like, I thought war is over. We're never going to be in a war again. We're a safe country. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. We'll never, I'm sorry, I thought I heard a click. I never thought that could happen to America, and I never paid attention to anything. I was just out of the loop at whatever age I was back then. You know, I was in my 40s. I should have been paying attention, but I wasn't. But ever since then, I've never stopped paying attention to anything and every little thing that's going on. So
it certainly was a wake-up call. And I think just speaking, even as someone who has always paid attention and knew what was going on, that was even, you know, I think it was shocking for everybody, you know, obviously for various reasons. And so it's good to hear your story, though, because I always like to, my goodness, too, Danielle, I can't believe the anniversary is coming up in a month, you know, a month from yesterday. And I don't want to belabor this because I want to get to your book, but it's just what's really scary to me is that for everybody who did wake up after that, I think more people went back to sleep and have been lulled back into complacency, unfortunately, and it's just sort of this tireless minority, you know, like you and I, that cares. Oops, I think Daniela dropped. Okay, guys. Daniela, if you can hear me, please call back in. You know, this is what happens with internet radio and certainly with storms, and I'm amazed that Skype is still working for me right now. But I believe I've got Daniela back on the line, so let me go ahead and bring her back on. Daniela, you back?
Yes.
Okay.
Apologies.
Well, we can't control the weather. But, you know, another thing you said in your bio that I really enjoyed was, because I love listening to how different authors, you know, how the writing process works for them. You know, it's such a unique thing for everybody. And so you were saying you were jogging one day and praying, and you just got this idea. So I think that's really cool. So, you know, when did you actually sit down? So you're jogging or you're walking through the cornfields and you had this idea, and where did it go from there? Tell us a little bit about the process.
Well, it happened on the road. There's a picture on my, excuse me, I'm having a brain meltdown here, on my website of the road where it happened, and it's very isolated. It's in the middle of a state park. very isolated, and the road is, it's an old road. It's 5 minutes from my home. I've been running there, and that was my always my time to, you know, ponder things and pray. And just I was just praying about how are we going to get out from under this mess we're in. With what was I, what I could see coming down the pike with the health care and everything that has happened since. If people were paying attention back then, they probably heard about all the people who were had reservations about this health care law. And all of a sudden, it just flashed into my mind about back alley births. That was the message that I got, where you would have to, rather than have a back alley abortion, you could have a back alley birth because you would be so controlled by a bureaucracy. Every little thing is controlled, and if you were not a candidate to give birth, you might not be able to, which has happened in China, and it is mm-hmm. it is the policy in China right now, and who knows where else, but that's where I got the idea, and I saw the corn, and I just, the idea went through my mind, and then I went home, and I just sat down at my computer, and I started, I'd never written anything, but like I said, some comments, maybe, you know, a journal entry or two. I read a lot of books, but I never thought, and I kind of thought, I always thought it would be cool to write a book, but it just never, I never thought it was possible for me. But I just began writing down these ideas, and it just went on from there, and I never stopped. That was in 2009, and I haven't stopped since, every single day. I rewrote the book. I rewrote it like 4 times. So it's not really like this is just the first draft that I'm putting out there.
Right. Well,
that's where it came from. So, yeah, and it just, I don't know how it happened. It was like a huge light just went off in my mind. I never stopped writing after that. So.
Awesome. Now, where are you in the process? Because Tears of Paradox is book one in a series of 3, correct, that you're going to write?
Well, I am going to write a third. I thought the first one and the second one, it was a huge, long manuscript. But I can't publish. If I'm going to self-publish, I can't publish that long of a book. And it's better that I did it this way. So volume two is finished, and I'm editing it, and I will be beginning to write volume 3. And I don't even know if I could even go on to 4. There are so many things yet to be written about, that, and so many different characters that can be elaborated on, that it could go on, I think.
Well, that's fantastic, because, you know, the advice that I see everywhere from successful independent authors is to make a name for yourself by writing a series, and kind of sounds like you were just intuitively, maybe you didn't know it consciously when you first sat down, but you were like intuitively on that track. So that is excellent.
Oh, thanks.
So you're kind of, you know, you're building your brand. So let's talk about that. I want to talk about Tears of Paradox a little bit. So are these characters, are they based on real people? I mean, I know certainly you've incorporated real life sort of political current events into the novel, but are any of your characters based on real people?
Yes. Not the main characters. They are just characters, but they have the kind of the same values as I do. But the Michelle is hiding with the family. And the family that she's hiding is based on guys.
Okay, Danielle, I'm sorry. I can't hear you very well again. Are you there? Oh, I think Daniela might have dropped off again. I hate it when we have technical issues. But let me, while I'm waiting for her to call back in again, I started reading the book, and one of the things I really like about it is the way she the point of view she juxtaposes points of view between the two main characters, and we go kind of from the past into the present and back and forth, and I really love that about. Okay, I think she's back on the line. Hey, Daniela, yeah. Welcome back.
Hi, I'm really sorry. If I had a landline, I would use it, but I don't.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. So, and I noticed that, you know, I was just telling the audience, I read, as you know, I read about the first 50 pages, and I could relate to all of these characters, all the ones I've come into contact with, I guess, so far, especially your two main characters. And one of the things you did that I really like, well, two things that you did, and I like this because I think it helps build the intrigue and keep a reader engaged, but the point of view goes back and forth between the two characters, Michelle and Jason. And you also go from what's currently playing out in the present with these characters back into the past. And I think that makes the book, I don't know, just gives it a really good pacing, and it keeps it interesting. So was that something you consciously decided to do when you sat down to write?
No. I didn't know what I was doing. It just happened over the course of like 4 years that it went that way. The first part that I wrote was Michelle speaking about being hidden and how she felt about having to hide and how afraid she was and alone, and it just went on from there. I originally thought that Michelle would be the only narrator, but I've heard other people say this who are writers, that sometimes the character will just take over, and that's what happened with Jason. He basically just took over as I was writing. A lot of him is based on my husband, and his views and the way he would act in any given situation. So it's very odd. It's a very, I'm sure you know how it is when you're writing. It just kind of takes over.
It does.
And, yeah. But anyway, the family is based on my family. The old lady, Patty, is pretty much based on my mother and some of her experiences. And the grandmother that they speak of is based on my grandmother. Oh, my God, I wish she was still here. She was the biggest character. but a lot of the stories are true. All of the stories about the mountains are true, except for maybe one that might be a fable that I put in there. But they're all true. They all happened, and I wanted to set down so people in the family would know that they did happen.
Yeah, that's great. Now, what have been, you know, how have various family members and friends reacted to your book, Daniela?
Well, I've had reasonably good feedback. My mother read the book and loved it. My mother-in-law read the book and loved it. My son's girlfriend, she loved the book. My son is in the process of reading it. He already read parts of it because I used his experiences in the military as the basis for Jason's military experience, and I had to ask him questions. So I had reasonably good feedback from everyone who's read the book. My husband loved it. My friends from church love it. Friends from work, one friend is reading it right now. And I don't really have any complaints. You know, maybe a couple people, you know, aren't really fans, but it may be because they disagree with the political points in the book. I don't think it's because of the writing.
Oh, no, I'm sure, yeah. I think you're right on track with that. I think it's largely due to, you know, the political stance that you take, and that comes out in the book. And that's another reason why I am so thrilled that we have the ability to independently publish, thanks to all these advances in technology, because a book like yours, even, you know, a book like mine, other books I've read by independent authors would never see the light of day if we had to go through the traditional gatekeepers. You know, in your case, it's too pro-faith. Catholic faith in this case in the case of Tears of Paradox, you know, pro-life, unapologetically pro-life, pro-freedom, pro-Second Amendment, and these are things that are not popular, which frustrates me to no end because, you know, all we have to do is look at history to know that it's repeating itself, and it's very, very scary that it's come here. I mean, Danielle, I don't often interview nonfiction authors, but I have interviewed in the past a gentleman by the name of Balázs Szabó, who escaped during the Hungarian uprising against the communists back in 1956, and he wrote a book called Knock in the Night. And, you know, I was reading your book, I was thinking of him. I mean, he's, you know, and he and others like him, people that I've met throughout my political activism and certainly in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, are just horrified by what's going on because they know from personal experience. So getting back to people who, you know, would choose not to like your book or criticize your book simply because of its political content, you know, I find that so frustrating that people have been so sufficiently indoctrinated, and this has all been by design, as I'm sure you know, that they can't even read a piece of entertaining fiction and at least consider it because they're so indoctrinated. Would you say that's been your experience?
Yes, I would. I, as an example, as an example of what you just said about the accepted norms and the indoctrination, I was just on Goodreads. I just joined Goodreads not long ago. And in going over my favorite childhood books, one of which was the Little House series and Little House on the Prairie.
I love
just
that.
Just reading. Yes, me too. Just reading the comments under, like the review comments under that book was such an eye-opener.
In what way?
All they were doing was they were saying that the family were racist. Because,
oh, my gosh.
Because of what happened. Yes, there you are. If you're on Goodreads, all you have to do is go to Little House on the Prairie and look at the comments underneath, and you'll see it. They're like, I don't know if I should read this to my children. Ma is a racist. Pa is this. And they don't take it in the context of when it was written. They don't take it in the context that Laura was questioning the accepted norms of her time with the Indians, and why would they say such a thing about the Indians? You know, it was completely over their heads. All it was is they're racists. And I'm thinking, wow, are they going to ban that book? Like, I'm sorry. That is what I'm thinking with the way people are being. The indoctrination that is coming in to our children and our schools and the colleges, and it scares me.
Oh, it's chilling. It's chilling, and this has been a concerted effort for at least 100 years. I think it's been it's been accelerated over the past 40, 50 years, and we are now dealing with the rotten fruits of it. I mean, anybody that
exactly
can't even, you know. And I wrote several years ago when I first started blogging, I remember writing a post about the Little House on the Prairie television series and lamenting the fact that we don't have wholesome television shows like that anymore, or they're few and far between. And I suspect it's because you have a very solid nuclear family that happens to be Christian and very rooted in their faith, and they live their faith. And, yeah, people have flaws in their show. One of the things I loved about it was, they admit there's human weakness and different characters, especially Laura, do, you know, things that they regret later on sometimes, but there's always forgiveness. There's always that bond of family and friendship and the structure of church and trying to – and hard work. That's another thing. In fact, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Laura Ingalls Wilder, and I'm going to probably screw up this quote, but she has a fabulous quote about hard work and about people who – maybe you know it, Daniela, about a farmer and this – oh gosh, I don't know. I should have looked. I didn't realize we were going to mention this, but she has a quote where she admires a farmer. People who complain about the smell of a farmer, you know, from sweating and working hard, this is them, and it's so true. And that's another thing that's lost today because too many people we've lost the value of a work ethic, which used to define one of the many things that defined America.
Exactly, you're totally correct. I agree. And also, yeah, exactly. She is someone that I've read. I read all the childhood books, and I read other works of hers. And I do know that her daughter, Ruth Wilderlin, became a socialist, but then she flipped back. She became a suffragette, and which is good. I mean, a suffragette is good, but a socialist, she went on to, you know, so like you said, 100 years ago, all this stuff was going on. Back when they, you know, and then she flipped back to her parents' way of life. You know, hard work, church, and I think that books like that should be taken in the context of the time they were written. They didn't know any different, and to take a book like that now and basically not even tell your children the whole story, I just don't agree with that. I don't like the idea of it. While pushing other books on the children that maybe you don't want them to read.
Well, you know, the desired end result here is to turn them all into wards of the state and very dependent on government in order to expand the power of government. I mean, that's really...
You're right.
And that's why, you know, what you're doing, you know, what we're all trying to do in the CLSA is so important, because you're not only, you know, you're telling an engaging story, first of all. And I want people to know, I know we kind of got on the political track here, but Daniela's book is also very entertaining. I mean, it's scary if you're the kind of person who's aware of what's going on, because you're going to see a lot of that reflected in the narrative. But, Daniela, you've first written a good story that's engaging. And I think that's an important thing to point out.
I tried to keep a lot of lighthearted, funny in it. My cousin was just telling me today that she just cracked up over the part where Jason's friend Brad was stuck on the toilet without toilet paper. Did you get to that part?
No, I would have definitely remembered that, yeah.
You'll crack up. Like, there are funny things in it. And I try to intersperse funny things throughout, because it is kind of a dark subject matter. But that's the way I've seen the world heading for the past 5 years. And a lot of it is coming true right now. The actual clinic that I mentioned in book one and book two, I thought about a clinic like that 5 years ago, but one really just opened up in Buffalo. It's Buffalo Women's Services in upstate New York, and it says right here in a New York Times opinion piece, Buffalo Women's Services is unusual because it is a birth and abortion center in one. It is part of an effort to reframe reproductive care as a continuum. The phase for it is full-spectrum reproductive health that spans both birth and abortion. Facilities for each are typically distinct. That's the exact clinic that I imagined. And here it is 5 years later, come into reality.
Yeah, scary. And, you know, the term reproductive health, how Orwellian. There's nothing about it that's health-related, certainly not for the unborn child. There's nothing that's good for their health in that clinic. Well, unless their mother is choosing life. And you know, God, it's so hard for me to reconcile that in my mind, that in the same building, you've got babies who are being born and others who are being murdered. And what's the difference? I mean, what's the deciding factor in that? It's just the arbitrary will of the mother, I guess.
I guess. I know. And like in the book, that's one of Michelle's biggest fears, is that when that clinic opens, and then she, you know, happens to end up there later through no fault of her own. So and here it is happening. Who would have thought such things could happen even 10 years ago?
I know.
I have never in my life thought such things could be happening here. These are the kind of things that you think might happen in a communist country, like you said, the person who you interviewed. I tend to take anyone who's escaped from such things very, very seriously. And I have heard numerous accounts on talk radio of just people calling in who've come from Cuba or one of the Iron Curtain countries or wherever the case may be, saying the same thing. We're headed that way. Why will people not wake up?
Yeah, I don't know. It's very frustrating. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the summer of 2009. I mean, I was one of those people going to the town halls and jammed in there with hundreds of other people and met, you know, of course, at the time I was living in South Florida. And I tell you, yes, I've met so many people of Cuban descent, Iranian descent. I'll never forget this one woman at a town hall who was literally in tears saying, I came to this country for freedom. I got out of Iran. You know, I don't want this. And just the smug, it happened to be a Democrat congressman whose, you know, town hall we were attending. He wasn't there, of course. He was too scared. He sent, you know, his staffers there. And the just the condescending of not just the looks on their faces. It's like I wanted to punch somebody while this poor woman was pouring her heart out, her and many others. And I agree with you. I don't know. It is. It's very, very frustrating. And the tactic that I'm taking, that and you are too, is that I think we have to engage the culture because Andrew Breitbart said culture is upstream from politics, and that is so true. It's not so much it's how can an electorate vote for the people that are in – and not just who's president right now. I mean, we have a political class problem. You know, the permanent entrenched political class versus the everyday American. That's what it is. There are no parties anymore. And the fact that we have an electorate that actually believes it's a president's job to put gas in their tank and pay their mortgage and they want to be dependent, that's what should scare the hell out of all of us. Because to me, that's the scariest thing.
It is. Because if a government is big enough to give you everything you have, they're also big enough to take everything you have away. I don't know who said that. It's a famous quote from somebody.
I believe it was Thomas Jefferson.
True.
Yeah,
okay.
I believe it was Thomas Jefferson who said that, and you know, that's the other thing too. And you know, when you were talking about some of the criticism of your book, it reminded me of Dinesh D'Souza's America: Imagine the World Without Her,
because
the same thing. They people just, it's like the truth is kryptonite to them, and they just don't want to hear it because they've been so thoroughly indoctrinated. But really, you know, the real rebels, if you will, the real cool guys, were those ones who in 1776 said, you know what, we're done with oligarchies, monarchies, dictatorships. We're going to create a system of government that recognizes that rights come from God, not the government.
Exactly. Exactly.
And those men are now vilified, just like what you're saying, you know, about Laura Ingalls Wilder and the Little House series. They're all vilified, and kids are being taught in school that our founding fathers were all a bunch of racists.
Right, and they're not. I've read... I don't know if you've ever read the John Adams book by David McCullough. Right in there, there is proof that John Adams and his wife were against slavery. I mean, they have letters written between the two. And I think Abigail Adams said in one of her letters that a plague that came on Philadelphia or wherever they were at the time, she felt like it might have been put on them because of America engaging in slavery. So they were not for slavery. It's right there in the history books. And if this was taught in our schools, rather than indoctrinating the kids with the opposite views that are out there now, we would be much better off if true history was taught.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I mean, slavery, I mean, you know, what's not taught anymore is that that was such a contentious issue. It was threatening to, you know, stop the revolution right in its tracks. And it was only, they finally figured, okay, we got a big enough problem taking on the world's greatest army, England at the time. If we need to be united in order to defeat. This is the enemy right in front of us. And they did, and that was very clear. I mean, anybody who's studied history, American history, or even seen the musical, I love the musical 1776, knows that. But again, it's not taught in school. You know, and Thomas Jefferson was against it. So
exactly. He was. So many of them were against it. But they just couldn't take that and the British Army on at the same time. Like you said,
exactly.
They had to be united.
And then, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say then we did fight the Civil War. I know there were other issues involved, but, you know, like Dinesh D'Souza's movie, we're the country that fought a war to end slavery. We're not the country that still has slavery. That's why America is great. The fact that many of our young people believe the opposite is just, it's mind-boggling to me.
It is.
It really is.
It's very disheartening. And, you know, the other thing that I'm so glad he pointed out in that movie is that just about every civilization in the history of the world has had slaves. There have been white slaves, black slaves, Asian slaves. I mean, it's not limited to any one race. The Romans had slaves, for example. And just like you said, I mean, we're the only country that went to war to end it. And I believe that's because the country was founded with, you know, belief in certainly in Christian principles, if not, you know, obviously not not under one religion, but certainly under the values and the principles of Christianity, that slavery is wrong, and that we all come from God. So I was so glad that he pointed that out. And the other thing, too, is that Africans sold their own people into slavery. We're not taught that in school. You know, I wasn't even taught that in school. And I remember I had a nun in the fifth grade. Oh, my gosh. I mean, that was all she talked about every single day was how bad slavery was and how, you know, black people were put up, and I'm certainly not arguing the point that slavery is evil, but she never once told us that, you know, other Africans sold their own people into slavery, so they do bear part of the responsibility for it happening.
True. Yeah, it's just, like you said, it's just infiltrated the schools, and in Paradox, and I don't know if it's, remember if it's in, I think it is in Tears of Paradox, Jason is lamenting all of this. Like, he was never taught in school about any of this stuff. And it's just, like, it's bringing this family to their knees. All of the things that are happening are just, like, storming upon them, like in the storm, and they're caught in the middle of it. And another thing, when you transform something, there will be collateral damage. It's impossible to avoid that. And that's what happens to this family. They are the collateral damage in this transformation. There's a lot of collateral damage going on right now. Like the people who have lost their health insurance, and there are many, even though the news won't report it. There are cancer patients who've lost their health insurance and who've lost their care, and that's another theme in my books. So it's all, like, hopefully entertaining, like you said. It's all sort of true or based on truth, and it's very scary.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the scariest elements, as you were speaking, Daniela, I thought of this, and it made me think of Balázs again, my author friend from Hungary, because you know, as the family becomes divided and trust is gone, that's what communists do. That's what centralized control does. They don't want people trusting each other and talking to each other.
Exactly. And that's exactly what happens in this book. They're all, by the end of the second book, they're all afraid of, they're just afraid. They don't know who to trust. The one nephew is completely, like, indoctrinated and just, they're afraid. They can't trust anyone. You don't trust your neighbors. You don't know who to trust. And you know, it's almost a little bit like that now in some parts. You're afraid to say anything. You speak out and say your view on something and you get shot down as a racist or a bigot or whatever the other words might be, which is as far from the truth as possible. You almost just think, oh, I just have to keep my mouth shut.
No, it's so true. It's really sad. I mean, and look at, you know, on a grander scale, I mean, look at Hollywood. I mean, now, thankfully, actors who've already achieved the success they desire have now boldly come out and taken a stand, some of them. But there's still so many that are underground. They're afraid to say what they believe. And this is in America. This is in America.
Yes. They are afraid because they just get trashed. James Woods on Twitter, he actually followed me last summer, which I was shocked out of my mind. But I follow him, and I've read a lot of the comments on some of his tweets, and they just decimate him. Just because he's a conservative and believes in the founding principles and freedom.
Yep.
Well, I mean, what is this? This is not Russia yet. This is not the Soviet Union. We have a right to our views. And you get trampled on.
No, it's true. But, you know,
it's amazing.
It's good to see. This is an expression Michelle Malkin always says too. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. I don't think she coined the term, but it's very, very mm-hmm. true. And one thing that it's very clarifying when you put posts out on Twitter, and you know, like in the case of James Wood, somebody famous like that, and he gets that kind of reaction, because it clearly defines the enemy. And really, to me, the enemy is just rampant ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And when you mm-hmm. see how ugly the statements are, it makes me weep for humanity that they've been so, again, indoctrinated
exactly.
and have become so nasty. And just what they try to do is just take away a person's humanity. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I believe you. I've seen tweets that would make your hair curl. I'm sure you have, too. They're bad. And I just, like, I want... At least people should be aware of this. Even if they agree with what's going on right now, and they agree with the health care, and if they agree with all the abortion and Planned Parenthood and everything else, you know, that they can get a child, 14, can walk into a pharmacy and get the Plan B pill. I went on their website this morning you know, in case the subject came up, and they have a Planned Parenthood for Teens ask the experts questions, and one of the questions on there was, can my boyfriend buy the morning after pills over the counter since he is 17? I'm the girlfriend, but I can't because I'm 16, and how much is it, blah, blah, blah. Actually, both you and your boyfriend can buy Plan B one step over the counter at the drugstore. It used to be true that the morning after pill was only available without a prescription to people 17 and older, but now the law says that anyone, no matter how old you are, can get Plan B over the counter without a prescription at a drugstore. Now, we're telling our children, don't take drugs, don't do this, you know, come to
right.
me, tell me.
these people
are telling them, I'm sorry,
yeah.
go ahead.
Don't drink a big gulp because it's got too much sugar. But no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's crazy.
It's mind-boggling. I mean, what if that hurt? What if someone took that and they were allergic to it, and that's your child, and they end up like, I just can't deal with it. It's so upsetting to me. It really is.
Yes, and I think you know another, and we don't really have time to get into all of this, but I think another
right.
cause of all of this, aside from the indoctrination, is that we have absentee parenting. I think we have a lot of parents who are self-absorbed, and especially if they're divorced. I know I saw a lot of this in South Florida, and maybe it's just indicative of that particular part of the country. I don't think so, though. I think that they're more involved in their own social life than they are, and also the obsession with youth in our culture, too. You know, and look, I like to look good. I wear makeup. You know, I do my hair and get my nails done and all that stuff, but I think it's gone to such an extreme that people are so self-absorbed about their physical appearance. We have mothers competing with their daughters. Instead of being a parent and exerting discipline, they want to be their friend and they want to compete with them and they want to be, you know, forever 21. Well, that's just not life. And it makes it easier for those who have an agenda, such as, you know, complete control, to exert that agenda.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. And I remember in your book reading that about the culture of what did you call it, plastic surgery and all of that. And I'm thinking, you know, that's really true. People just want to stay young. It's like they want the fountain of youth, and that's not real.
Yeah, And that's what makes these kids so vulnerable. If you don't have a strong parent or parents, set of parents in the home, which sounds like, you know, you did, I did, and I'm very thankful for that every single day, especially if I watch what's happening.
Yes.
So many kids don't, and they're susceptible to this leftist agenda. But Daniela,
right.
we are, gosh, my goodness, the time has gone by so quickly, but I want to give you an opportunity. Let everybody know where they can find you online,
okay.
your blog, Twitter, and everywhere, and we'll definitely bring you back again to kick this around some more. I loved the interview today. It was so much fun.
Oh, Daria, thank you. I loved it, too. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity, and I'm thankful that you like my book and that you're promoting it. Okay, my website is DanielaBova.com, DanielaBova.com. I do have a blog, but it's down at the moment, so I'm working on getting it fixed. I have a Twitter. It's author Daniela, at AUTHORDANIELLA. That's on Twitter. I have another Twitter account that I started years ago before I knew I was going to be a published author. you can link to that on my bio of the Daniela account. That one gets more traffic. I'm building the Daniela Twitter. I have a Facebook page for, like, an author page, just Daniela Bova. And it will talk about Tears of Paradox on that page. And you can email me through the Daniela Bova. There's an email link, and there's a link to Facebook and a link to Twitter right on the website.
Fantastic.
So,
great.
Yeah.
And people can if you're interested in purchasing Daniela's book, it is available in Kindle and paperback, and the best place to go for that is Amazon.com, Daniela?
Yes, Amazon.com is where you can get it, and it is available in paperback, and it's available in Kindle. It's $3.99 on Kindle. So, and it will have a free day eventually, but right now it's $3.99.
Oh, my goodness. You can't ask for better than that.
Yeah. I agree. I think that I'm willing to pay for a good book, you know, pay $3.99 or even more.
Yeah. Well, all right, everybody. Well, Daniela, thank you so much for joining me today. Please, and also, let me just throw this in there, too. After you read Daniela's book, and I'm sure you'll love it, please post a review. It's very, very important. That is like the lifeblood for an author, or reviews. So
yes, please.
I will definitely be posting one after I finish it. So,
thank you, Daria.
All right. Well, thank you, Daniela. It was a great interview. Really enjoyed talking with you. And good luck with the second book. Keep me posted, and we'll bring you back to talk about it.
I will. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
You too. Have a great day.
You too, Daria. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. That was author Daniela Bova. Please get her book, Tears of Paradox. You will not regret it. It's a great read. It really is. Okay, well, I'm going to take a quick break here with Madison Rising and the Star-Spangled Banner. We are running a little bit behind, but I know I want to break this up a little bit. I see that Griff is here on the line already. We are getting ready, or actually the Prince of White Bread. I'm sorry. I should announce that correctly. The right-wing riot will get underway here in a few minutes with your host, the Prince of White Bread and the Luminaries of Liberty, Ms. Scary Smart and Ms. Always Right. Stay tuned.
Can you see? Thanks to our friends over at the NSA. Always glad to have you stop in. Are my fellow rioters present?
Yes, we are.
All right. Well, welcome everyone to a special vacation edition of the Right Wing Riot. The president is on vacation again this week. And didn't he imply in 2008 that he's going to dedicate himself full-time to the job? I have a clip. And I also have an echo, but let's see if I can get past that. So let me play this clip for you all right now.
All right.
You have to understand, if you seek that office, you have to be prepared to give your life to it. That you're essentially the bargain that any president, I think, strikes with the American people is you give me this office, and in turn, my fears, doubts, insecurities, foibles, need for sleep, family life, vacations, leisure, is gone. I mean, I am giving myself to you, and the American people should have no patience for whatever's going through your head because you've got a job to do.
Yeah. I know. I don't have any patience for it.
I'm
sorry. Let me interrupt y'all just for a second. Are you getting an echo from me as well?
I'm getting a terrible echo.
Okay.
I'm getting
everyone. Okay. Well, I tell you what. I will let you all. Jamie, why don't you tell us how many vacations it's been for Obama?
Actually, let me try to call back again. I think it's my end that's got the echo.
Okay, so I'm going to...
just stopped echoing.
What's that?
I think that you just stopped echoing.
I just did.
Yeah,
but I like to hear
job.
Myself talk.
Ah.
So now it's just me and the mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right.
Hey.
So vacation. Let's see. So it was. I just listened to that. I can't help but wonder: is there ever anything Barack Obama has ever said that actually has the lifespan greater than a fruit fly? Because you know. He was saying, by golly, you've got to dedicate yourself, your need for sleep. Well, his need for sleep apparently was pretty important the night of Benghazi.
That's what I understand, yeah.
Yeah, of course, since those documents are probably lost, along with the IRS documents. Wait, I think I see Jamie coming back in. Ms. Scary Smart, you there? Let me press a button. Hello.
Nice. Yes, I'm here now.
Okay. Is the echo better, y'all?
I'm glad that you mastered that button pressing thing.
You know, 4 years of college will do a lot for a guy.
Oh yeah.
So let me give you your cue again. Speaking of vacations, Scary Smart, how many is that for President Barack Obama, who in 2008 told us, you know, you had to give up your need for sleep, recreation, golf, vacation, getting jiggy with Beyonce and Jay-Z. How many vacations has he taken?
It's actually really hard to count. His first term, he took a total of 13. He took a vacation.
So those are official vacations, correct?
Those are all official.
Mm.
He took one to Hawaii every year. He did one to Martha's Vineyard almost every year, and he's doing that every year now. Then, of course, you can't forget Michelle's jaunt. She went off by herself to do things.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the kids' vacation to, the Bahamas last year. It was Atlantis. That's where they went.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there was that. Then you have the big trip that they took with the whole family to Africa. So
right.
Safari. That was such a bargain. That only cost us $100 million. Did you know that?
Well, that's chump change.
Just one vacation.
And, you know, now that Michelle Obama's proud of America at last, she deserves that kind of vacation. Imagine the stress of living with a junior senator from Illinois when you weren't proud of America. That just must have been really
very
harsh.
Very hard. Yeah.
And I'm going to guess, if I can interject here, I think the problem we have with counting his vacations is that somehow Barack Obama manages to do a great deal of fundraising that ends up on a golf course.
Part of it is the fundraising. Part of it is also his overseas trip.
His what?
He's taken his overseas trip.
Ah, yes.
Right.
As of March of this year, he took 31 trips overseas, 119 days total, which is more than any other president before him. He doesn't seem to do a whole lot on these trips, except bow to people.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say those are kind of vacation E too, you know.
One might think.
I think they were basking in the glow trips. Yes.
Yeah.
Look at me, I'm hanging out with these guys.
And you've got the permanent fundraising trips.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, whenever he needs to go talk to anybody in America, or whenever he needs to go fundraise anywhere in America, he tries to fold that into a business trip. So if he talks to somebody on the tarmac for 5 minutes, say, you know, the governor of Texas who has got some issues right now, that gets counted as a business trip. That means that the taxpayer picks up the whole tab for the whole trip. And And he goes to his fundraiser, and that doesn't cost his fundraising people anything.
Well, he is a very accomplished boondoggler, that is for sure.
He is. He has taken, we don't know everything he's done. He doesn't have to comply with the FOIA. So some of the things we know, some of the things we don't. We don't know all of the expenses. We have no idea what the total is. But we do know that as far as trips on the Air Force One and trips using his official motorcade and things like that, we're looking at $44,351,777 and 12 cents.
Just for travel.
Nothing else.
Wow. Huh. Well,
must
you know,
be nice.
It is good to be a Democrat president. because the press is remarkably blind to most of what you do. However,
I'm not interested. Yeah.
You know what? President Obama may be on vacation for how many times? Just this term? This second term? What is this? Eighth time this term?
At least, yeah.
Okay. We'll be generous. We'll say, you know, it's only his eighth vacation in the second term of office. But the right-wing riot is not on vacation. We are here for you, doing public service satire. And so, Igor, you know what to do.
Igor! Dude, show starting.
Welcome to another edition of The Right Wing Riot with your hosts, the scary smart Jamie K. Wilson.
Every morning when I get late, should I go in and report to my boss?
The mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right.
Do we think that this is going to start being as obviously stupid to everyone as it is to us?
And Griff Griffiths, who is the Prince of White. Let's get this riot started!
Just so much fun to play that, but Igor is just a terrible producer. He gets paid peanuts, but still, he's got to do a better job than that.
You would think he'd improve over time.
You know, you hear so much about elephants' memories. I'm not sure, you know, Igor fits the stereotype. But we'll abuse the producer later. So, in keeping with our theme of vacations and who knows how many Americans who are out of work haven't been able to go on vacations because they're looking for jobs or perhaps
enforced
they've
vacations.
Enforced
yeah.
The government approved vacations right there.
Mm-hmm.
We have been thinking, and it was actually our fill-in producer this week, the mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right, who gave us the theme. She was thinking, who isn't on vacation? And we know the right-wing riot's not on vacation, but Ms. Always Right, who else has skipped the vacation this year?
Oh, many people are still working away. They are not on vacation. A prominent group that comes to mind these days is the Southern Invasion, the people who are invading the country illegally, with no reason not to, nothing slowing them down. So illegal immigrants are continuing to stream in across our southern border at a rate of one every 40 seconds at the moment. That's the last I heard. Unfortunately, our Border Patrol seems to be on a mandatory vacation. They are not there to stem the tide at all. So
a few of them have been speaking up about that. They are not happy with the situation
as it is. Can you imagine being them?
Scary Smart, tell us a little more. What has Texas Governor Rick Perry been doing about the flood of illegal immigrants into his state, my home state of Texas?
I don't know any details, but I do know that he's been sending the National Guard down there. I know that there are also a lot of militia groups that are headed down that way. I don't know if they've been able to stop anything or catch anything, but there they are, you know.
I just thought it would be nice if they would just repel people at the border. I don't understand this apprehend them once they're in and then, you know, give them free school and health care and everything. Just repel them so they don't come in.
Well,
it's not our problem then. It's Mexico's problem, you know.
It's one of those, how are you going to enforce the law? And that's how they decided to enforce it. But, you know, at the same time that the National Guard is down there on the border trying to keep people out, the Border Patrol has been pretty much benched. They have mostly been sent to desk duty. Mm. And there are a lot who are complaining because they have absolutely nothing to do. Think about that.
Well, now, isn't it, there's so much there, it's hard to pin down any one thing, but sort of the whole idea of the border security is not being enforced. Did not Congress pass some laws regarding, you know, the legality, what is the appropriate and legal means to enter our country and to wish to become a citizen, a member of our society? Is there not something written somewhere about that, Scary Smart?
There are lots and lots of laws about that, but it doesn't seem like any of them are being listened to, except for one. There is one that's being listened to. There was a law passed in 2008. It was designed to stop sex trafficking of children.
Mm-hmm.
And what it says is if you are not from Mexico, you are not from Canada, you're not from our two border states, or you're our two border countries, then in certain cases, I'll note that in certain cases, we need to do a little bit more than just ship you back to your home country. We need to make sure that you're not actually being sex trafficked. And if you are being sex trafficked, then we're going to treat you as basically a refugee. So they've forgotten that in special cases, and they're just treating all of them that way, as long as they're from Honduras or Guatemala.
I don't suppose that could have anything to do with the surge in
No, of course not.
Absolutely. No? All right.
I'm sure it doesn't, no. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's just a complete, an innocent coincidence, much
Absolutely.
Like the fact that over 20 Obama administration departments have mysteriously lost emails that are being requested as part of various congressional investigations. Again, just an amazing coincidence.
I have out of work IT friends. I mean, obviously they need some help down there. I mean, there's certainly plenty of people who could use a job who are competent at this sort of thing.
Yeah, there are. There really are.
Yeah, I'm sure they could find some.
Well, we may have to revisit that some more. But speaking
of shovel-ready job to me.
The shovel-ready job was the people telling us that they'd lost their emails. But I digress.
Shoveling something.
But speaking of the porousness of the border, have any so we've heard that Vic Perry's got the National Guard down there, and it, maybe they're at least being like that little sign that people put up outside their house, you know, protected by, hoping it'll scare off the burglars who can read, and some militia groups. But is anyone else concerned about border security? I mean, apparently Barack Obama is not serious about it. Has anyone else taken an interest in that subject, Ms. Always Right?
I understand that American folk hero James O'Keefe has taken an interest, and he recently graphically illustrated how very dangerous for all of us this open border is. He, you may know James O'Keefe. He's the guy who brought down Acorn by dressing as that ludicrous-looking pimp, which was hilarious, by the way. And again, if he were on the other side of the aisle, he would be an enormous folk hero. But, you know, unfortunately, he's on the right side, so they try to put him down as much as possible. Otherwise,
they tried to put him in jail.
That, too, yeah.
Right.
But, otherwise, it would be all over the news that the other day he dressed as Osama bin Laden and freely crossed back and forth across the border. And it was kind of hilarious. And you can go to the Daily Caller and look at video of this. He had no problem at all. And he illustrated very clearly that this is not just a threat to the American way of life. It's not just lawlessness. It's also an invitation for terrorists to come in that way and do as they please. So I thought that was a pretty hilarious illustration.
Let me put this in context. So someone went to Mexico, which I guess it's only difficult to get out of Mexico if you're a Marine. But
correct.
Someone went to Mexico, put on, shall we say, the stereotypical I am a bomb-throwing Islamist jihadist.
Not just
outfit.
Any bomb-throwing jihadist, the bomb-throwing jihadist. Right down there, the Osama bin Laden mask.
And he put on a bin Laden mask, and he skipped blithely across the border. It was water, wasn't it?
It's very shallow there. It's way out
so,
here, I think.
So he went waiting for Obama from Mexico to Texas, not once, but many times, dressed like someone that might be of interest to law enforcement, might be of interest to perhaps the NSA, And yet, no one stopped him. No one of a law enforcement nature said, hey, yo, what up?
No.
Is that essentially correct? Ms. Always Right.
Yes, you are correct. That is right. So it's a very, very unnerving illustration of the porousness of the border. This is not something new. As everyone knows, the border has been porous for a long time. This is a 1-2 punch we're getting right now. The second part of the punch is the executive actions and DREAM Act agitation and the law that Scary Smart just told us about. So, but the border has been porous for quite some time. In fact, a similar stunt was done in 2006, which really made me laugh at the time. So at that time, you recall, George Bush was president, and he was...
You mean the evil genius George Bush, who got us into Iraq only to make money for Halliburton.
Right,
to get,
Bush Hitler.
War for oil, and because George Bush hates black people. That George Bush?
He also hates brown people and was trying to get support to build a 700-mile fence at the time. But, of course, the wise progressives in the Congress were able to prevent that from happening. So at that time, a very clever young man named Raj Peter Bhakta was running for a congressional seat in Pennsylvania. He actually was a contestant on that Donald Trump show. What was it?
The Apprentice?
Thank you. Yes, he did not win on The Apprentice, but he was running for office. He pulled an even funnier stunt than James O'Keefe. And, in fact, I think Igor probably is familiar with one of the people involved. In there was an elephant involved as well. Yes, indeed. And Mr. Bhakta was able to ride an elephant back and forth across the Rio Grande into and out of the United States. And he even had, and I don't know if our producer, Igor, would be able to provide a musical accompaniment, but Mr. Bhakta, Mr. Bhakta and his elephant were accompanied by a mariachi band. And that is what it sounded like. Mr. Bhakta and the elephant and the mariachi band crossed and recrossed the border. And it was an outright mariachi band. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Yeah, it was a nice touch.
Speaking as somebody who's done a little law enforcement in a former life, you know, I've done some shooting with shotguns and M16s, but just as a law enforcement type person, I'm thinking an elephant is a large target.
Mm-hmm. You know what? You're really being insensitive right now.
Yeah.
Can you please think of Igor's feelings? Come on.
It just has to be said, but an elephant is a large target, rather obvious. It's not, when you want subtle, you don't think elephant.
Or mariachi band.
Or mariachi band. And it's just so peculiar to me that this obvious, radical, crazed, evil right-winger was able to do this without drawing the attention of the occasional law enforcement person who should be enforcing our border per our written laws.
Imagine, yeah. No, there was not a lot of problem back then, but again, the difference was that at that time we had an evil racist president, so he would sometimes enforce the laws regarding immigration. So even if you were able to sneak in, you weren't guaranteed a stay and a free ride. So there is the difference between that and the situation today where the president is actively subverting the laws of the nation that he swore to uphold. And so you have a much better chance of staying.
It's kind of, when you put it that way, I mean, you can make anything sound bad when you say it like that.
Sorry.
You think of like the legal immigrants who come here and they go through the process. Doesn't it take years, Scary Smart, typically to go through the immigration process to become a legal citizen?
That's just if they can even get it started. There are a lot of people who have trouble just getting a green card. Even when they've married an American citizen, it can take 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And would I be incorrect in suggesting that probably the people who are in what we call the legal line for immigration aren't receiving the same benefits that are currently being dispensed to the people coming over the border today at the rate of one every 40 seconds?
I think you'd be fairly accurate.
Are you implying that we are rewarding people for breaking our laws?
I'm just asking. I'm trying
it
to put it together.
It sounds like that's what you're implying.
Oh, darn it. Yeah, you know, you might be on to me. Because it does, in fact, seem like we're saying to the people, break into my house, but once you're there, the government is telling me I have to let you live in my spare bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
I have to provide you groceries. I have to drive you to school if you have school children. I have to make sure you get to the doctor. And anything less than that is bad?
It's racist.
It is racist.
Mm-hmm. Which is a form of bad, a prominent form of bad, yes.
It seems like in a lot of cases you also have to learn their language.
Wow.
Yeah.
Golly.
So.
Okay, well, so we recognize that the people coming to America, not in the Eddie Murphy sense, but in the we are sneaking in because we have been told and we've heard and we've seen pamphlets, they're not on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Who else is not on vacation? Ms. Always Right?
Oh, another group that is not on vacation is some classical Islamic terrorist specialists. ISIS is the name of this particular group. They are not on vacation as they continue to work very hard to cleanse Iraq of Christians, especially in the beleaguered Nineveh province of Iraq. So, of course, our president is busy golfing and fundraising on his vacation over on posh Martha's Vineyard. Meanwhile, ISIS is merrily burning down churches, lopping the heads off children, raping their mothers, and crucifying their recalcitrant Christian fathers. It is beyond medieval. It predates medieval by thousands of years. I don't even know what you call this sort of behavior.
But wait, I'm sorry. I just have to ask. Islam is... According to Dear Leader, according to President Barack Obama, Islam is the religion of peace. How can this be? How can the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria...
Translated wrong. It's translated wrong. But
wait?
It's the religion of pieces.
Okay. All right. We had a synonym. Is it a homonym? Is it a homonym problem there? You know,
I think it's a homonym problem.
Yeah. So no homo. The religion of peace is merrily chopping up people. And what else are they doing? So give us a little more detail on that if you can do it without making Igor yak.
Are you asking me or Scary Smart?
I don't really want to
delve into those details a lot more.
Ms. Scary Smart, I think you're a little bit up on this story, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Fortunately, not as much as many, because I cried all day over one thing yesterday. So, if they don't just outright kill you, then you are a demi. You are lesser than they are. You are the equivalent of an unclean being.
Mm-hmm.
And they expect you to pay jizya, which is a special tax, 10 to 20%. It used to be 10%. It used to be basically a tithe, and they charged the Jews that. This was back in, the day of the Turks and, the caliphs, and way, way back. But now, it's all back because they need money to run their jihad. Mm-hmm. And so they charge you jizya, and they will charge you 10%, and then they'll come back and they'll charge you another 10%. And maybe, if you're really, really lucky, they won't come back and kill you anyway.
Hmm.
That's basically the way they're running things over there. That's why all those people went up to the mountain and are starving to death and dying of thirst.
Oh, yeah, they're getting the hell away from that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
wow.
What are your choices?
And just to put a little more recent historical context in this, when did the ISS begin to appear on the scene with a lot more ferocity and a lot more weapons?
Well, that would have to be right about the same time the Benghazi incident took place, wouldn't it?
It was around that, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, we can trace an entire line of incompetence and failure in the Middle East by the Barack Obama's administration. And who was the Secretary of State head of foreign policy at that time?
Gosh,
it's
woman,
on the tip of my
it?
Tongue. I want to say Monica, but that's not right.
No.
But it's close, right?
Yeah.
It's
one
of
those.
Yeah.
It was Hillary Clinton.
I think it was.
God bless Google. So,
the smartest woman in the world, Hillary Clinton?
You know, it is. It does beggar the imagination.
Mm.
All the humanity and all the fans feeding around.
Yeah. So, the ISS was not that big until there became this series of cascading mishaps. What was that word?
Failures.
Thank you. I was using the wrong term. In the Middle East, under the administration of Barack Obama and the close personal guidance, supposedly, of Hillary Clinton.
Well, there is nothing like killing an American ambassador and getting away with it to help build morale if you're building up a movement. Anyway,
that's great recruiting poster material, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Look what we can do. Yeah.
Yeah. Join us. Kill ambassadors.
Ambassadors.
Kill American ambassadors. Violate sovereign American soil. And walk
kill
free.
Whatever they've got.
Yeah.
Kill whatever they've got in there.
Yeah.
Which brings me to another question that I have.
Yes, ma'am.
Supposedly the CIA station there was rounding up all the weapons that we had given the rebels in Libya. Whatever happened to all those weapons?
We could do a whole show on that because there's a lot of things about Benghazi that just aren't available. Those weapons haven't been accounted for. The people who actually survived Benghazi have been remarkably absent.
Mm-hmm.
The ones whose lives were saved by the Special Forces guys who died? Yeah. Not by the president, not by anybody who could have sent them help, but by the Special Forces guys. They would have been killed.
Right. And they would have. There would have been huge death toll. So, but anyway, the point is we're making a very solid link between Barack Obama's failures and the rise of the ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
They started in Syria during the botched Syrian civil war, in which Barack Obama drew a red line in the sand, which had the same. Yes, he did. He was playing tic-tac-toe. We just didn't realize it at the time. And he even lost that. That's how confident this dude is. The red line in the sand had all the staying power of Barack Obama's spine and any promises he's ever made as a candidate or as a president. And I'm sure the world is watching and they know we can't trust this schmuck. He will always stick us with a check. So he failed, terrible response in Libya, and then Egypt, the most competent administration ever continued to send mixed messages to Egypt. And then it was just sort of this amazing wildfire of people saying, we're going to take our shot now. And in the chaos that arose, and again, due to the Barack Obama's mishandling, or complete lack of handling of any of these situations, it only emboldened these kinds of groups. And under what president did American troops leave Iraq? Somebody remind me?
I believe it was the current president who made much noise about how that was one of his positions.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, I think when he was running for election in 2012, he was quite proud of his success in getting Americans out of Iraq, because that was one of his promises. And this weekend when he began to tell a different story? What's that, Scary Smart?
He said he kept that promise at least.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he does keep promises.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
Wow.
Not the one about vacations, though.
No, that one was not kept.
Yeah. But yeah, so Barack Obama has done pretty much everything in his power to enable Islamists to arise. George Bush left him a relatively stable Iraq. It was obviously plagued by people from neighboring countries who did want to overthrow the democracy. But when George Bush left the presidency, Iraq was still a democracy and a basically unified nation. And now, 6 years later, under Barack Obama, most of Iraq is under the control of this Islamist group, which is carrying out a genocide. Would that be a fair word to use, do you think?
Yeah,
completely.
Yeah.
A genocide against Christian citizens of that country.
Christians and Kurds.
Kurds have been on the list too.
Kurds have always been on the short end of the stick over there. Everyone's mean to them.
I know. I like the Kurds too.
My gosh. They're as unpopular as Jews over there. My gosh.
Well, that, you know, I don't think we can hammer that point too strongly, that this group of savages, they're complete barbarians. They are, in fact, shooting children in the head. They
chop their heads off. Ugh. Go on.
They're gleefully posting pictures of their children holding up severed heads.
Yeah.
They are, as one of the ladies said, crucifying their opponents, slaughtering unarmed prisoners.
Yeah.
And
they're old school men.
Very, very Old Testament in this way.
Mm-hmm.
But that brings us to... Press the button.
Welcome to this next edition of Moral Morons.
So, the moral moron of the week are, in fact, too many to list by name. But anyone who's been weeping tears over the, quote, Israeli genocide, unquote, in Gaza... and who has not this week been marching and protesting and hashtagging and tweeting and Facebooking and being a person who cares enough to take a selfie about the ISS slaughter of the Demi, and as Scary Smart previously explained, that's any non-Muslim who has the bad luck to be a citizen of a country taken over by the Islamist jihadis. Anyone who is not up in arms about the Islamist massacres of unarmed soldiers, Christian men, women, children, babies, the rape of those same women and children, anyone who isn't completely outraged by that, those people are moral morons.
I think those are too kind a word.
Yeah.
too kind a term for them.
Yes, and you know, I was thinking, when I was thinking about this segment, I was thinking about the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe, where it was always sort of simmering, sadly. And I'm not sure that makes them morons or idiots. But unfortunately...
Or worse.
Yes, it's beginning to show its ugly head in places like Boston, where there have been pro-Palestinian rallies that were shouting things like, death to the Jews, Heil Hitler... go back to the ovens. And for any of our Jewish... that one never gets old.
No.
For our Jewish friends and the friends of Israel everywhere, there's a fine book called Guns and the Third Reich, which discusses the way Hitler's government systematically disarmed the population, including the Jews, well before the Final Solution. If that doesn't make you a fan of the Second Amendment, I don't know what will. And when we hear on American soil people yelling, death to the Jews, go back to the ovens, I become intemperate.
Intemperate, yeah.
Yes, especially with these people completely ignoring the horrific deaths of Jews and Christians in the Middle East.
Yeah,
yeah.
But enough of that. Moral morons, you know, sleep well tonight. That's all I can say.
Sarah Palin? She's stupid.
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah. And another one that is evergreen. And excuse me. I actually want Scary Smart's help on this because she brought it to my attention. Because Mitch McConnell, a longtime serving Republican from, was it Kentucky, Scary Smart?
That's my home state, from Kentucky.
Yes, and he's a senator, I believe, or he was.
He is.
He's a senator.
He's the senior senator, I believe. So.
Okay. He is a person of pallor, a pasty white evil Republican who is married to an Asian woman. Now, as we just sit for a minute and sort of take that in.
I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen.
I mean, how dare he break, you know, those sacred Republican rules of genetic purity? But why don't you take it away, Scary Smart, and tell us a little more about this?
Well, Elaine Chao is his wife, and they've been married for decades. I'm not sure how long, but it is a long time. She is a Taiwanese. She's Chinese, but she's from Taiwan. Her parents actually fled the Communist Revolution back in 1949 and did quite well, and eventually she emigrated to the United States. And she's a really remarkable woman. She was the head of the Red Cross for a long time. She served under President Bush as the Secretary of Labor. And there has never, ever, ever been a word of scandal breathed about this lady, about their marriage. They seem to be completely happy. I'm not a Mitch McConnell fan. I think he's a turtle. But their marriage is a good, strong marriage. Well, some idiotic, Democratic, Kentucky peon in the somewhere in the Democratic Party structure decided that she was going to be cute and tweet, "By the way, you do know Mitch McConnell is married to an Asian." And she tweeted this 3 or 4 or 5 times.
Why?
Because, okay, this is the thing about Kentucky. Kentucky had a lot of residual racism when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And when McConnell first married Ms. Chao, there was a little bit of controversy.
Okay, yes. so that was 20, 30 years ago. And
least,
what you're saying is a pasty white, evil male Republican married an Asian. And the response is this?
Folks agree that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world.
Now it is. Yeah.
That is not the reaction, right?
No one cares in Kentucky anymore.
So, and what did this Democratic sleazeball operative person of principle do?
Oh, she just tweeted about it. She wanted to make sure everyone was aware that he was married to an Asian, and you could sense the breathlessness in her tweets. It's like, married to an Asian woman.
Well, it is kind of disgusting when you think about it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
No, I can see why Democrats would be affected by that, yeah.
Yeah, and do you know the name of this this fine individual? Who?
I don't remember. She was...
I have it right here.
You do? Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Thank you, Igor, for handing it to me hot off the printer. Her name is Kathy Groob, G-R-O-O-B, a self-described advocate for women in politics. Apparently only the correct women in politics.
Correct.
Okay, with her. Because actually she took to Twitter on Saturday to repeatedly, I mean, not once did she say this is an offhand comment. She was apparently thought it was pretty important. She repeatedly noted that Elaine Chao, a former labor secretary, that does sound like a woman in politics. I could be wrong.
Yeah, a little
one would think, yeah.
Yeah. And McConnell's wife is Asian. So here's a quote from Kathy Groob, self-described advocate for women in politics. Quote, "Hey, Mitch, nothing against you, sick wife, and spouses should be off limits. Since you mentioned she isn't from Kentucky, she is Asian."
Yeah, that's Kentucky right there.
Wow.
That is a certain attitude. But you know what? I don't see it among any of the Republicans or conservatives I hang with. They think that she's a pretty cool guy, pretty cool person.
So can help me parse out this woman's racism then? Is it that she, or it could be either kind of bigotry, is it that she herself is incensed about the interracial marriage, Or is it that she is so bigoted against Republicans that she thinks that some of them just weren't aware of this, and once they found out, they would no longer support the Mitch McConnell?
I think it's a little of both.
It was a very strange thing for someone to say, especially someone who claims they're an advocate for women. Apparently, her full description is an advocate for the correct liberal Democrat women in politics.
Right.
I'm sure Ms. Grube is not an advocate, for instance, of a Sarah Palin in politics either. I'm sure she would not advocate that.
I don't see her doing that either.
No. I think you have a point.
I think part of her point was that unlike Alison Grime, who is Mitch's beleaguered opponent, Elaine Chao is not from Kentucky.
So she was just being xenophobic, not necessarily racist or bigoted. All right.
I think it was all of the above.
Wow.
There's a lot to figure out. Yeah. Very complex woman, Ms. Grube. Wow.
Well, she's real complex. She deleted her Twitter account after people correctly pointed out she was being a dribbling arsehole.
Ew.
Yeah. Well, and she also did this just before Fancy Farm. Fancy Farm is a big deal in Kentucky. They have it every election year, and everybody who's anybody goes, and all the politicians go down there, and they give their big speeches, and it's like a festival. So it's a Kentucky thing. So she did it right before Fancy Farm, too. So of all the times to do it, what an idiot.
Well, as long as we keep in mind that every liberal's superpower, they all possess the superpower ability to peer into the hearts of Republicans and see the secret darkness there. And all I can guess is she was hoping to provoke everybody to put on their Klan hoods at that point in time. And
exactly.
You know,
reveal themselves as they are. Yeah.
Indeed. As she knows they are.
She is diabolical.
She is. She has such superpower. And so that...
wow.
Yeah. So again, remember though, because our betters have always told us this.
Sarah Palin, she's stupid.
And we just want to thank Kathy Grube, G-R-O-O-B, no longer on Twitter, for being this week's fine contributor to prove that, once again, Sarah Palin is stupid.
Very nice.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I hear somebody making noises back there.
No, I'm just agreeing.
Let's take a brief musical interlude now to wash the stupid out of our mouths.
Shake it off.
I could never understand how he does these riffs with those big paws, or whatever you call an elephant's feet, but that's just me. He's a very talented, large gray pachyderm.
He's good.
Yeah. Okay, Igor, enough. Stop. Stop now. Thank you. So, and yet, this vacation is...
Oh, my gosh.
You
get
know,
it together over there.
You can't get between an elephant and his muse. It's really, you know, nobody wants to be there. And yet, there's still another group that, bless their hearts, to use a Southern phrase, bless their hearts, they are not on vacation either. I mean, if Barack Obama's on vacation, somebody has to pick up the slack. Somebody has to do the heavy lifting of continuing to do their best to create disunity, division, and general unhappiness in the world. And what group would that be, Ms. Always Right?
That would be our fine American race hustlers. They are certainly not on vacation this week. It's almost as if their party might be alarmed that they're about to get shellacked in an upcoming election, and it's time to start riling up the base. And we all know what that means. It's time to sift through all the reported crimes and police actions and find an appropriate incident or two, hand it off to the complicit media and rouse the rabble, basically. So summertime is especially effective because the weather is fine for marches and so forth. And they are not resting. They are not on vacation. And there are two incidents currently being worked by these ruiners of lives. In our post-racial age of Obama, you would think this stuff wouldn't happen so easily, but apparently this is a time-tested and true recipe for outrage. So there are two unfortunate deaths, and no one ever is happy about that. But, you know, things happen. There are actually many, many unfortunate deaths, but as I say, they sift through them and find specifically what they're looking for, which is a dead victim who was technically unarmed at the time and that was killed in the line of duty, usually, or in the commission of a crime sometimes, by a white officer. Now, one of the reasons... I'm sorry, go on.
So the victim, to actually get the all-important attention of the alleged Reverend Jesse Jackson, who has no church, and the equally alleged Reverend Al Sharpton, who I believe does not actually have a divinity degree, to get the attention of these two outstanding members of society who have contributed so much. For instance, Jesse Jackson has contributed at least one child out of wedlock with a young woman who was on the payroll of the Rainbow Coalition, but it is impolitic of me to mention that. The important fact to gain the attention, the empathy, the concern, the deep caring of these outstanding members of society is the victim must be a person of color, and the alleged perpetrator must be a person of power.
Correct. And preferably in a position of authority.
Okay. So only if it's a black victim killed by a white person, can they make any money off it? Would that be correct?
I'm not sure what the exact money-making mechanism is in this case. I don't think that's what this is about. Oh, you are?
Go ahead.
They asked for donations for their foundation.
Well, yeah, that's all part of the overall rabble-rousing. That the rabble-rousing accomplishes a great deal. It does that. It motivates the base. It also does myriad negative, damaging things to society. Whatever.
Raises their speaker's fees. Gives them an excuse to go on television. Raises their profile. They profit all kinds of ways from it.
Yes. Someone did an entire book about how Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition was essentially a shakedown machine, threatening corporations with various legal maneuvers and protests and bad publicity if they didn't make contributions to the coffers of the Rainbow Coalition so that they could continue their work in healing the racial divisiveness in America.
Well, that's a well-known way of raising funds.
It is indeed. And the sad thing, all snark and sarcasm and scorn aside, is neither of these gentlemen, and I use the term in the loosest of ways, neither of these gentlemen, to my knowledge, has had much to say about black-on-black crime. And to me, that is a true... First, that is the genocide going on in the black community. Is young men are 8 times more likely to be killed by another black young man than by a white person. The cynic might say, "Golly, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton can't milk white liberal guilt cash accounts, bank accounts over black on black crime."
It would also fly in the face of the wisdom that all the problems in the black community are caused by the man, so the white man. So you can't really bring that stuff up. It kind of hurts the cause.
I'm sorry. Please, go ahead.
I was just going to say that one of the reasons this particular kind of incident is so frustrating is because there's just a lot of built-in leverage that these horrible people can get out of them, and that can't be helped because good people won't cheat and do things like that. For instance, the two incidents that are going on right now, one was Michael Brown, an 18-year-old killed in Missouri. The other was Eric Garner. I think he was 43, and he was killed last month in New York City during an arrest. apparently he is an asthma sufferer and he had a heart attack during the arrest and so forth. But one of the five officers required to subdue him as he resisted arrest was putting him in a chokehold, which is not illegal as reported, but is banned by the New York City Police Department. So it's an infraction there. Again, horrible, horrible, horrible. I'm so sorry anyone died. But the thing is, both of these cases are ongoing investigations. So that means that the police, who know the truth, cannot give out their side of the story. The only side of the story anyone is going to hear for months and months now is the side of the hustlers and mongers, and, of course, amplified by their friends in the media. And I remember this from the Rodney King case all those years ago. They took an entire video which showed a man speeding a car out of control, flying out of the car, attacking the police officers that were evading him, fighting him, fighting him, fighting them. And at the very end was the horrible beating. You know, you almost can't blame the guys for having a lot of adrenaline in their systems at that point. Again, what they did was wrong. But that was the only section of this video that anyone ever saw. And we saw it over and over and over every night on every channel. And that's what they do. They cut out every bit of evidence and the
whole
situation.
Every bit of context.
Yeah.
Yes. It's completely context-free.
Yeah. They'll show you the 1 or 2 seconds that they want you to see. And unfortunately, there's a whole segment of the population that gets riled up and all the unpleasantness that follows that. And again, I am pretty certain that this is largely related to the upcoming elections. We want to make sure all these people vote against the vile, racist Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Who are, in fact, the root of all evil and the source of every
Correct.
Problem in their life.
Correct.
All right. Okay.
Not on vacation.
And we do wish some of these people would go on vacation, in fact. But we can't get everything we want for. I think the president's on vacation for another 10 or 12 days. Events in the world will continue to spiral, absent a lot of calming American influence, because that's what he does, is much like his career in the Illinois Senate. He has voted present on a lot of things in American history.
Now, in his defense, he called in an airstrike or two before he went on vacation. In all fairness, he did call one or two in.
Wow. In all fairness?
Four bombs. Four bombs.
Four. All right, so I stand corrected. Four.
And they were pretty pathetic ones. But he can say he called in an airstrike.
Oh, I got to go. There's my call.
You do. I'm sorry. You can't be fair to him.
Ooh.
I'm banished.
And don't come out to your radio to be, you know, unfair and unbalanced. And then we'll get you your journalist card, and you can join the rest of them.
Man. You are strict.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have less than a minute and 40 seconds to go. Next week, let's do something wacky. Let's interview the creators of that transgressive new comic strip called Truesberry. What do you say?
That could be very interesting.
Truesberry? Yeah. I've heard of that.
And, you know, I think if people Google it, it's spelled T-R-U-E-S-B-U-R-Y. It'll take them to a number of sites where it can be seen. And I think our right-wing riot listeners will enjoy taking a look at that.
I bet they would.
All right, ladies, we kind of got riled up ourselves today, and we didn't leave ourselves time for our usual plug-a-rama. We'll have to make sure we do more of that next week. And anyone want to say a quick shout-out in the next 10 seconds?
No, I'm
good. He's got his finger over the button.
Yeah, not me. Good.
Take it away.
Take it away. If elephants can truly be said to have fingers. Let's see. All right. Press it again, Igor.
Oh, my gosh.
We're out of time for today's riot. You can find us on the web at rightwingriot.com. No hyphen, all one word, Right Wing Riot. Thanks to our generous internet radio host, Daria Ann DiGiovanni.